This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast. And here I am with my historical co-host. That's not saying that he's old. It's Jorn. Hello, Jorn.
Note, he's also not saying I'm not old, but Rip Van Winkle, well, 10% of it, because he was 100, if I'm not mistaken. Or I don't know, a long time ago, but yep. Episode 2 of our 10-year retrospective series. Going full steam ahead now, talking about something everybody should care about.
Should they?
The keepers of our society.
God.
The Mount Olympus of protection. I think there's going to be some sarcasm in this episode.
Yeah, I've no idea where this is going. This is going immediately straight off the rails, 90 degrees down into a crevasse. But hey, there we go.
The topic of today's episode is interactions with big tech companies and how that has changed over the last 10 years, at least as seen in our little reality distortion bubbles, of course, mm-hmm. as always. I did a big intro last episode about why we're doing the 10-year retrospective series. We're not going to repeat all of that. So what I'm going to say is that it's going to have minimal editing. It's more of a stream of conscious kind of episode thing. It might run a little bit long. I mean, first 10-year retrospective ran over an hour, I think. So we'll see how much of our time these big tech companies deserve. Now, this was one of the ideas I put in the doc, I think. So I'm going to give you first dibs at when I say, let's talk about big tech company interactions, what does that mean to you? See, making your work.
Well, I'm going to cheat slightly because I already do remember the perspective that you shared on this. And if I sort of go completely off the rails here, then it will make even less sense than our episodes normally do. So I'm going to stay within the broad confines of at least the vaguely the same trajectory as you. And when we started this podcast, casting our minds back, a lot of the interactions that we had with, you know, what I would call some of the luminaries in the space, the Netflixes, the Facebooks, the Yahoos, the Googles, the, like, you name it, if they were kind of big in this particular space, they were, it wasn't just like a name and a company. Like, we actually knew people at these organizations. We met them at conferences. We listened to them speak at conferences. Like, they shared the honestly, like, exciting and amazing things that they were doing with technology. And I mean, certainly, I wouldn't speak for you, Jorn, but I certainly learned a great deal about the state of the art and where things were heading from these individuals at these organizations during this earliest of times.
Yeah, definitely. But you're not talking about the CEOs of the company, right? Not even the CTOs, although sometimes, no. But really the people doing the stuff who were able to just talk about the stuff they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, often these folks were principal engineers or distinguished engineers, or, you know, they usually did carry, you know, fairly lofty titles, or they were heads of departments or divisions or teams or whatever, you know, but they were all folks that were, you know, hands-on at some point or some level of hands-onness. Like, they very much knew in detail what it was they were presenting on, talking about, and you could feel that from both the Q&A that often followed a lot of these kind of sessions, but also, you know, just from then chatting with these individuals after their sessions, and, you know, getting a chance to, you know, we were even, I would say, lucky enough to get several of these individuals over the 10 years onto the podcast itself to actually interview them further. And there was, I think that if I had to come up with one word to describe like all of these sessions, I think the word I would use would be passionate. Like they really cared about what they were doing, and what they were doing was cool. And I would almost say sort of like infectious. Like the audience you could feel was like really interested in what these people were showing, and the and they were solving like really interesting, gnarly, kind of tricky problems that many other folks were also facing in that same space.
Yeah. I mean, yes, they had lofty titles, but they grew into those titles because they built something that was recognized and got into positions of responsibility / power, whatever you call it. These weren't people that were hired from another company to be the management of a certain division, coming in with, no background, no pedigree. Now, this was, I think, something that was very specific for the open source environments, because in the closed source environments, that was a lot less the case, because all things about patents and secrecy and secret source, and you can't talk about things. So we made a very specific decision to go for an open source podcast, not an open source podcast, I should say that, a podcast about open source and community, because that didn't directly gave us access, but at least gave us a chance to have a chance at getting access, because we knew the access was available if we only did the work and tried to get it and try to get these people to talk and go to the conferences and go to the talks and things like that. There was a potential of having interesting conversations with these people. Doing the same even 10 years ago for a Copternic Oracle, for example, would have been almost impossible, because they, even then, and again, 10 years ago, memory is a funny thing, but I can't remember any company, and I'm using Oracle because it's an easy scapegoat to blame for a lot of bad things, but fill in any commercial, we get the Teradata, SAS, whatever, there are a bunch of them from those days. They didn't really have a lot of sharing in that same vein. So I think you were lucky in one way to grow up in a time in a time where this was still possible in open source. And well, as this discussion today goes onwards, I think you're going to at some point start talking about how things changed.
Yeah. The change is, I think, trickier for me to talk about. I think primarily because in the first, 4 or so years of, well, 3.5, I guess, years of the 10-year period, I was an individual contributor. I was therefore kind of, at conferences and that sort of thing. Like I was there, in a lot of cases, I was there to learn, to like absorb as much as I could from the conference itself. Meet customers and that sort of thing as well. But there was a big part of it, of my time at that point, that was around learning from these luminaries. And I would say that changed fairly dramatically for me over 6.5 years ago now, when I moved back into a more of a leadership role. And
We already talked about this. I have forgiven you for that misstep. Let's not go into that again.
It is what it is. But that meant that my role at events like this was less about learning the deep technical, amazing, awesome innovations that were happening in the space, and was more about supporting customers at these events, so spending time with them, and making sure that my team instead had the time and were given the space to engage more on that front. So my memory of the early first sort of 3.5 years of this sort of 10-year retrospective, especially on how big companies were interacting with their communities, with their audiences, with the rest of the ecosystem, it sort of I have a less clear picture of what that felt like from that point onwards.
Yeah, I'll go in more depth in a minute, but long story short, you didn't miss much. But in those early days, you say you went there to learn stuff. It was the only way to learn that stuff, because the books explaining what they were doing hadn't been written yet, because they were still making it all. And the whole big data scene was moving so fast. We talked about the crazy innovation we had in those days and in previous episodes. The only way to stay somewhat up to date with what was happening was by going to these events and hearing the people who were making it, were writing the code about how they were thinking, which way they were going forward. And for me, this was the first time I was a solution architect on the pre-sales role, which kind of meant that I had to be proactive in gathering information and having the answers before my users, customers, whoever I'm going to talk to, are asking the questions. It was a huge, difficult period. A lot of fun. I mean, it was amazing, but it was the only way to do this. And I loved going to conferences then, because you came back with so much information. And that's basically why we started the podcast. We came back from a Hadoop Summit, DataWorks. The Hadoop Summit was the first thing, with so much new stuff that we wanted to talk about. And going on a podcast episode on the new Hive thing, on the new whatever it was one of the reasons that, for me at least, we started recording episodes to talk about this cool stuff. And again, also making sure that the information that we got, because again, at conferences, things weren't shared on Zoom or online or anything like that. That only happened post-COVID and during COVID. That happened a lot. But before that, if you weren't at a conference, if you weren't one of those 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people, you didn't get it. You didn't get the information. If you were lucky, it got shared on a video sharing platform somewhere. But those are typically edited and more marketing vehicles. The raw truth, well, you were there, you weren't.
Yeah, and it wasn't just that the sessions themselves, like that was a big part of it, but you'd be there through the sessions, and then you would, you'd get a chance to bump into the speakers at the lunch line, or in the corridor, or I remember the community felt like an incredibly open and inclusive community. Like, people were very open to sharing, and this is something I've always said, like, don't just show me the end result, like, show me how the sausage is made. Like, I want to know the journey. I want to know what you tried. I want to know what went horribly wrong, like what you got wrong during that, and what you learned most importantly. And even if some of those sessions were sort of, companies have done webinars for decades, like that's been a thing, but the thing about doing stuff live and being able to chat with presenters is that there's more. To me at least, it seemed like it was a far more time spent on sharing and educating and talking about the journey that was experienced, rather than just the polished, hyper focused, here's the impressive end result.
Yeah. And also just being in the audience and seeing what the audience reacted to, because sometimes I'm sitting there hearing something and I missed something. Make a note, figure out later. Just that gave a lot of help as well. But of course, it wasn't totally altruistic from the speakers. I mean, they also did this because they wanted to build communities. I mean, the only reason that a Spark, a Hive, the Spark versus what's it called, a Flink, the whole battle that happened in those days, we used to say Spark had better marketing. Well, in today's world, that would not be a correct statement. Spark had better speakers who were able to capture audiences and share stuff and do it, while the Flink people were more, not bad people, not far from it, but not that open, outgoing. I mean, it's a hard thing for technology people who are very smart and very strong in developing new code. Those are typically not the most those are typically introverted people. And putting people like that on stage, I know from personal experience, trust me, is not an easy thing to do. But if you did it well, then that was where greatness happened. And I was in awe of some of those people. I mean, I still remember our interview with Mr. Gates. Mm. And probably a lot of people are thinking Bill Gates. Nope, I'm not talking Bill Gates, because one, he would never talk to us. But two, I wasn't impressed with what he did. But Mr. Alan Gates, that was one of my, I'm going to say, childhood heroes. Okay, I wasn't a child at the point anymore, but the idea from it, it was just having been to conferences and listened to what he was talking about and being in awe of what they were creating. And then having someone like that come onto the podcast to talk to us, I was kind of, wow.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, you're right about a big part of this was the fact that it was all being built we were whatever the example you want to, building the plane as it's flying through the air, or whatever example you want to insert, shoehorn in. But it was very much a time of rapid innovation as a community. People were, again, you can talk about building on the shoulders of giants, but even the giants were building on each other's shoulders as well. It very much felt like, yes, these were organizations, these were businesses, Yahoo, Netflix, Facebook, all of these. All of these organizations, even even the vendors in this space, the Hortonworkses, the Clouderas, the Mappars, all the different folks that were heavily invested in this space, they were all yes, there was competition between them, and even if you look at the folks that were contributing to this stuff as users, there was still a healthy amount of competition between those folks. But everyone was interested on kind of progressing this community. Now, if you listen to our previous retrospective on how things ended up going in the world of big data, yes, it did fracture, and yes, it did kind of all go very differently in towards the tail end there. But there was still a feeling that everyone was in this together. And I berated is not quite the right word, but I chastised Jon last time for talking too much.
I like
about
berated AI. More than chastised, sorry.
for talking too much about AI, because we have a dedicated episode on that coming up. But to contrast that with the current flavor of the moment around AI. Yes, there is absolutely a huge amount of innovation happening in the generative AI world. Yes, that rate of innovation is incredibly aggressive, and we are seeing similar sort of things like that. But what I don't think we are seeing as much is this collaboration. Open source. Mm-hmm. In my mind, is not yet, I desperately hope that one day this will change, but is not really at the forefront of where these things, a lot of this innovation is happening behind closed doors in one of a handful of very much big tech companies. But it's not happening in community, in collaboration, it doesn't, this isn't like an ecosystem that it feels like everyone's working together on, which, you know, I think is a shame, because the experience I had during that experience, the early stages of big data, I think very much shaped how I think about collaboration.
Yeah.
And about working together across boundaries, regardless of how you define those boundaries.
Yep. And I have a conspiracy theory that I had in mind when I promoted this topic, and I haven't told you yet, because I don't tell you everything. I mean, he knows everything. I told him everything he knows, but I haven't told him everything I know. Because, again, I have no proof for this, absolutely no proof. It's just a feeling, and I'm kind of wondering what you think, and hey, audience, what your audience thinks. But what I see changed, or I think I saw change, is that companies deliberately tried to take away spotlight from people. Because in the olden days, you had the projects, the hives, the Ambaris, that was like these cool names, and you had the people behind them, and you knew who was that. Alan Gates was Hive, that was the person behind it. And that was powerful, that was something that companies could use. It could put Alan Gates on stages and promote it that way, that worked, but they were dependent on those people at some point. And if those people decided, hey, I can get more amazing things, money, achievements, whatever it is that they were looking for somewhere else, well, if that person left, they didn't just lose a person, they kind of lost a big chunk of what the company stood for. So I have no proof, but that's with AI, at the moment, I have no idea who's building this stuff. The people talking about AI are Satya Nadella, the guys from Google, the Zuckerberg. Those aren't the guys Altman, making it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And Altman, you might say, had something to do with the creation stuff, although we don't know. And that's a big difference. And I think there has been an intentional motivator by companies to take away the hero workshop, if you like, because IP, patents, are things that are tied to a company, which you can control and contain, but the people, you can't. And they first stopped allowing these heroes, let's use the word hero, from talking what they want to talk about, but gave them scripts to read. And even stupid idiots like me were not allowed to talk freely anymore, but just, this is the slide deck you have to present. This actually happened. That's why I don't go to conferences anymore, because why would I? And I do think it was intentional. And I think unintentionally, this broke a lot of things, because all of that interaction, that community, brand loyalty is sometimes good. I mean, if you have a certain brand of car and you always drove that brand, and you think it's a good brand because whatever reasons, you will buy that brand again. If you like Starbucks coffee, you'll probably always buy Starbucks coffee. If you don't like Starbucks coffee, you probably won't go there. I mean, brand loyalty is one thing, but they're still companies, and companies don't like you. I mean, it's not because it says Nike or Adidas or whatever that they are good or bad. They're companies. They're in there for the profit. That's what they do. And people sometimes are so religiously attached to a certain brand that sometimes, and look at, I would say, look at Twitter. Please don't. I haven't in months. But all of these flame wars on social media are basically often generated by brands being pushed once against the other. And that's a negative thing, because now everybody can hate and dump on AI because there's no person behind there. If you knew that certain person who did certain things built something special within AI, it's no personal, it's totally anonymized. And that, I think, cost the world more than it gained the companies from doing this. And my conspiracy theory is not that this happened, because I'm pretty sure it did. The conspiracy theory is that it was a intentional goal by big companies to make this happen. In the olden days, 10 years ago, a Microsoft, when they started talking about open source, created heroes to talk about this stuff. Today, with the AI craze, nobody's creating heroes anymore. The opposite is the detractors, the people that are fighting against it. I mean, I forget the name, one of the fathers of the internet, I forget his name. Has been doing a whole...
Tim Berners-Lee?
I think so. Anyway, there's a couple of notable people from the olden days that are starting to use their still existing hero status to be socially relevant and give commentary on what's happening. But that's from the other side, and they definitely don't have all the money and budget that trillion-dollar companies have, so they will always get snowed under by the big company, the big tech companies. And again, we're talking about big tech company interactions here, not about the small startup things, which can still try to do this. But that's the same thing. I'm not going to stop talking because I want to give you a chance. But last thing, that's one thing you also see with big companies buying the small companies. They buy the small companies, which have a couple of vocal people, and once they're bought up, you never hear from them again. Not the companies, the people.
Yeah.
Too dark.
I mean, it... Honestly, I can't poke many holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty watertight. I wonder if this also... This kind of situation also happened around the same sort of rise of things like, or is the increase in things like non-compete contracts?
I don't think so, because in most of Europe, non-compete contracts are illegal. It's only in the US, because that's such a legit country that those actually get enforced, because I've had non-competes and you can't go work for another company the same thing in all my contracts in Europe, and it has never stopped me any which way. I mean, I've never done a real direct jump like that, but I know I've looked this up. I used to have legal insurance, and I had them look it up, and they are definitely in EU countries illegal. They're more of a detractor, and if those had worked, they wouldn't have needed to do it.
Yeah, but they are a lot more common outside the EU. They're especially common in the US, where I believe they are a lot more enforceable.
They are, but they didn't work again, because the only non-competes you want to make work are for the people that everybody wants to hire away from you. And if big tech company A wants to hire person X from big tech company B, they will just break the non-compete and pay the fine. Because don't forget, things like this are not illegal. They're only illegal for poor people. That's how fines work, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I can definitely see this connection being made. The one thing I do wonder is... is this part of our own reality distortion bubble?
I don't think so, because this is happening across every industry. The whole hero worship is gone. It might be a little bit my distortion bubble, because I've been watching movies about famous people like Ray Kroc and things like that. I mean, McDonald's didn't used to be McDonald's, it used to be Ray Kroc. Now it's McDonald's. If you looked at Mercedes and BMW, for example, the old general managers or the people who built the engines, Formula One sports, for example, often now you know the drivers, because the drivers are on TV, it's just what it is. But the people behind the tech stuff, you don't hear that much about. Except if they're very controversial people and they do it anyway and then they get fired. But I think it's across the board. The whole companies, industry, organizations have just decided or discovered or whatever it is that hero worship can be extremely powerful as long as you can control the people. And to be fair, you can't control people. They will do their own thing.
Do you think this is? I can definitely absolutely see that. I'm wondering if this is a product of like the big data ecosystem being so focused around open source and therefore being more open and collaborative, and that we don't really have a similar thing, or yeah, similar like space that's as active and as important today.
That's why at the start I said that we were able to learn this stuff because it was an open source movement, because open source is, or at least was, a hero culture. Linux is Linus Torvalds.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. And the reason...
I thought it was Tux the Penguin, actually. I thought, didn't he write the first version? And then Linus like took it over later. Was that right?
Yeah, yeah, but penguins don't get legal rights. So it's a whole thing about animal mistreatment. So let's not go there. Ah, come on. but no, I mean, we were lucky that open source started at some time in the, should I say, 70s, something. Because in open source, we got a revival of the hero culture. Outside of open source, it was already dead because, I mean, at Oracle, I know Larry Ellison. I don't know anybody else. I never have.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that it makes sense on the proprietary companies. That absolutely makes sense. And in our current state in the world, that also makes sense. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to...
Don't forget that open source also gets more and more bankrolled by companies.
Yeah.
The projects get bigger. They need that sustenance. It's not, and if we could, no, it's just how it needs to happen. So the 10 years ago open source is a very different animal than today's open source. We've already talked about that on different episodes as well. By necessity, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it has consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sadly, I think that does check out. So,
wow. For once, I'm controversial, and Dave doesn't. Wow, he don't push me down for once. Yes,
is
achievement achieved?
Is this something that I was going to say? Is this like, is this something that could be reversed?
It is something that will be reversed, in my opinion. But not in our lifetime. Just like in the 70s, open source suddenly happened. It was a reaction to something, and it was a reaction to, and now I'm talking about before I was born, so I definitely don't have first-hand experience, because even though I believe in reincarnation, I think it's my first go.
Memory's still a bit fuzzy.
well, it has to be my first go, otherwise I'd be a cockroach. But I think if you look at the world wars and everything, people have reacted to geo-global things happening in different ways. And wars are terrible. There's no other ways around that. But afterwards, people feel free again, and the sky's the limit, and people go for things that they would otherwise never have done because there was a period of repression before it. And again, that's not saying that that's a good thing. It would be much better if that wasn't the thing. But in the last almost 100 years, well, more than 100 years, and almost 100 years. We're getting close to almost 100 years without big wars, and not without wars. There are definitely other wars in the world, not going anywhere near that. But here in this little part of the world, thinking Europe, US, things like that, we have been pretty much war-free-ish. And yes, Ukraine and everything. Not saying that that isn't happening. Please don't put words in my mouth. But a world war situation has been absent for quite a while, so things have been able to stabilize for quite a while. And after the Second World War, you had the creativity happening, and then it died down again, and the whole hippie movement of the 70s, the 60s, 70s, in my opinion, was kind of a resurgence of, hey, let's push away the constricted corsets of commercialism, whatever, and be free again. And for me, open source has some roots from those things happening. I mean, it took a decade longer because you went from a social movement to a more technology movement, and that doesn't happen overnight. And now I think we're going back into a very strict regulated. You know what we tell you, and if you don't know, then it's because you don't need to know situation. And there will be a reaction at some point, and it's already happening at certain points. And things like social media can be a good thing, can be a bad thing. It all depends again on who you listen to. AI is going to be horrible for it, I think, because AI is clenching down everything and it's overloading everything with, well, anything and everything, whatever. We'll talk about AI in an upcoming episode, but there will be a reaction to this. And again, it's slowing down. It's like the economic waves. This one is apparently in Kondratiev of course, because it's going to take decades longer. That's why I say in our lifetime. Probably not. But that being said, look at how the world stage changed six months to a year ago. If certain people want, things can happen very quickly.
Yeah, very true. And I think that that's probably what this comes down to, is there enough desire to change the status quo of today?
I once read a quote which I thought was very troubling, but very, very true. People deserve the leadership they have, whether it's good or bad leadership. And there's different ways of looking at this. This is a philosophical discussion, but...
And this is not a philosophy podcast, just to be clear.
Not yet. We'll see over the next 10 years, I guess. People overthrow governments. Governments suppress people. People overthrow governments. It's not the other way around. So, I mean, you have to fight what you get. And I know a lot of people in my little country here where I live are shouting at the people in charge and the government and the ministers and whatever. But they keep voting for the same people. What they say about democracy is it's a horrible way of doing things. But it's like the best of the bad ones.
It's the least worst option, I think, is the phrase often used. Indeed. Well, this is neither a philosophy podcast or a political podcast. But unless you have anything else to share on this particular topic...
Oh, so much. But as you say, at some point you have to kind of stop talking and start doing things. So that's what I just said, I think. And by doing things, we actually say stop doing things, because that's all the time we have for today. It's been a little longer one, this one. We'll see next week what we do. But that's pretty much what we had to talk about on the big tech company interactions. And we had some bullet points we didn't even get to. So maybe they'll pop up in one of the next 10-year retrospectives, because I have a couple of more of these coming up, building up towards our 10-year anniversary. So with that, we like our patrons. Patrons help us do this fun stuff. Well, we think it's fun. We hope you think it's fun too. You can go to our web page at www.roaringoff.org. Information about podcasts, the Patreon page, and things like that. And you can send an email to podcast@roaringoff.org. If you think we're saying things we shouldn't be saying, or if you have other views, let us know. We'd be happy to learn, because that's what we're here for. Until next time, my name is Jan van Winkel.
And my name is Historical Dave.
I look forward to philosophizing with you again next week.
See you then.
See, I was really emotional. My voice broke.
Oh.